So, welcome to the Netzpolitik.org podcast. My name is Markus Pekedal and my guest is Jeremy Zimmermann.
Hallo.
Hello. So, I think you got the record for being the third or fourth time on this podcast.
Yeah, it's maybe.
Fourth. You bet Cory Doctorow.
Oh, it's an honor.
Yeah. Let's start with some introduction. You are known for being one of the spokespersons of La Quadrature du Net.
Yes, I'm the spokesperson and one of the co-founders of this citizen organization. We're kind of toolbox for citizens to understand what is going on when the fundamental freedoms are attacked on the internet, and a toolbox for everyone to participate in trying to change things. So we are currently working mostly on the EU level on the questions of net neutrality and copyright and ACTA in particular.
Yeah, we will come to these topics later, but let's dig a bit into the history of your organization. Mm-hmm. When have you been founded and what's your organizational structure?
So we technically got founded in early 2008, in February, I think, which coincides with the publication of the leak, actually, of the first draft of the ADOPI, the three strikes law in France. But indeed, we were preparing that for months, if not years. The five co-founders, we were all, I would say, experienced activists in the field of free software or software patents or opposing the transposition of the UCD in France.
European Copyright Directive.
Yeah, the 2001 directive. And so we thought when Nicolas Sarkozy was elected that, well, it coincided with something much larger where we would see the internet being attacked as such, something that went beyond what we were defending when we were promoting and defending free software. So we felt the need for a new angle, a new way of action, and learning from our previous associative experience and so on, we came out with this idea, to answer your question, of doing the most lightweight structure as possible. Maybe we'll come to that later. But I think we've been people did better than us at non-structures. I'm thinking of Telecomics, for instance. They're even less a structure than we are, and I admire that. But La Quadrature du Net, we are not even a legal entity. We are just four co-founders. We were five initially, we're four. And we just speak in our name. So we say what we have to say. We explain to citizens that it's now time to act on this, on that. And if people appreciate what they do, well, they follow us. And if they don't, well, they can do their own. So we chose that in order not to have, you know, board meetings, general assemblies, managing membership fees or anything like that. We have no members, no president, no legal entity. And therefore, we had to create, friends of us created a legal entity only for the purpose of collecting money and distributing it to us. So even that part is kind of outsourced, so to say.
So who's managing your money?
So it is an association, a Verein called Fonds de Défense de la Neutralité du Net, for Net Neutrality Defense Fund. Its statutes are very transparent. It is controlled by four people who are kind of dinosaurs of the French free internet infrastructure, who are very notorious and trusted people. And the fine works in that way, that it receives money for a project and sends that money to that project. So it's a kind of wallet organization with actually today only one pocket in the wallet, that is La Quadrature du Net, but it could open several pockets and get to fund other projects. And yeah, that's it.
So, and how many paid members are working for you?
We are 2.5 full-time. With tremendous expense, we constantly travel to Brussels, to Strasbourg, or take taxis to be more efficient, or make international phone calls all the time when we need to coordinate and organize and so on. So an important part of our budget, not half of it, but not very far from it, is expense in general. And the other half, well, the bigger half, so to say, is for salaries. And we are currently looking forward to get a place, an office. So far we were so much of a non-structure that we didn't have a physical place in the real world, but now we realize that we obviously need one at this stage. So we are looking for a place, and in Paris it's quite difficult.
Not as easy mm-hmm. as in Berlin.
Yeah, maybe we should do it in Berlin, actually.
Yeah, you should. Who's giving you money?
Well, the most part of our money, so for 2011, we had 120k euro budget. For 2012, it will be 140. In 2011, the most part came from individual donators, individuals, citizens, who gave between 5 and 1,000 euros. And the rest, but the biggest donor as such, was the Soros Foundation, the Open Society Foundation, who funds projects aiming at reducing corruption, reducing the digital divide, or access to knowledge, or things like that. So the Soros Foundation will now fund us for the fourth consecutive year, and we still hope that the main part of our funding will remain our supporters, because I think it is the healthiest way of being funded.
Was there any criticizing or critics on the French level when you were founded? Because when we founded Digitale Gesellschaft, we thought about having a lightweight infrastructure like you do, or Open Rights Group in UK, or Bits of Freedom, and the biggest critics was, oh, it's not open, not everyone can be involved. And
Well, I think the main difference is that you had already quite a huge visibility with Netzpolitics. So it was, you started in the light, so to say. When on our side, we started in the shadow. Nobody heard about us, and we sent press release after press release after press release after press release for months with no reply until it started. So no, we didn't have to face that at first. But yeah, regularly when we call for funding, you have the usual troll saying, yeah, but where? I want to know precisely where each euro is spent. Until then, I won't give. And I say, okay, don't give. You know, we tell you how much is the global cost for the salaries, the global cost for the expense, what in the expense, you know, is travel or communication or this and that. If you want more, and we cannot give you more, then just get out of here, you know. And yeah, sometimes people come also with governance issues, saying, yeah, but who takes the decision? And you know, and actually we explain it. It's simple. We are four, we co-founders, and we spoke in our name. If you disagree, you can tell us, and we might update what we say. But it is, we made this choice of, kind of centralizing the decision, because we just need to be efficient and go quickly. Sometimes we send a press release 1 hour after something happened. You cannot ask a board or consult your members or use liquid, whatever, to try to get the words right. You know, you have to have experienced people doing it and doing it right.
So your first project was Hadopi. It's still not really working, is it?
Well, it was our first, yes. Well, it is an ongoing political failure and technical failure in France. We're not anymore working on that. We worked on that when nobody heard about it. We worked on that when it was hot, to be sure that our vision, our political lines were central to the debate about fundamental freedoms and not stupid consumer issues about the way the musical industry makes its money, for instance. But now that is out there, you have dozens of groups and news websites and so on who are delighted to every day add some more and more and more and more to the failure. So we're a bit out of here. But to give you a quick status update, it's been 1 year or 1 year and a half that the administrative authority, ADOPI, is functioning. So they hired something like 50 people with their 12 million euros taxpayers budget. They have a huge communication service. They have tons of interns and so on. And they receive their reports from private companies who surveil the public peer-to-peer networks. So they receive IP addresses in their reports, and without having any way to verify if the IP addresses are correct or so, they send emails saying, oh, we saw you, and beware. So they send millions, I think, of such emails. Then the same IP come again, so they send letters, oh, we warned you already, now beware. And that's about it. There was no third strike yet. So normally the third strike would be when the IP address is caught again to send the dossier to the judge. But what we said from the start is that there is nothing in the dossier. The dossier is just a list of IP addresses. No judge, I hope, in France or in Europe would say, yeah, this is sufficient evidence. You, sir, will have to pay, will go to jail, will have your internet cut off or whatever. So this is what we say right from the start. And I think that the ADOPI knows it as well. And so they invented this 2.5 strike, when they said, okay, so we selected some people, how you don't know, and we send them a message that they should come to Paris and visit us so we talk together. So some of them said, well, no, I won't come to Paris. If you want, you can come to my place, remote place in France. And so this was a public outrage and so on. So they moved, they sent a delegation to some place in France. And he was a 40 or 50 years old professor who doesn't know anything about the internet and said, I didn't do it. And so finally his case was dropped. But actually with that, they hope to talk with the people. So the people say, yeah, it's true. It's me. I did it. I did download. And then they have something in the dossier. So unless people self-incriminate, unless people confess and say, yeah, I did it, they have nothing and nothing will happen. So our bet is that there will be no third strike before the election, and that after the election, most probably whoever will win, ADOPI will probably disappear. And as a funny thing, one of the members of the authority, the administrative authority, had to be replaced. And the president of the Senate had to choose a new member. And the Senate recently shifted to a left-wing majority. So the president of the Senate appointed to the ADOPI a member of the parliament who is an opponent to ADOPI. So this is the latest news. So it will wreak havoc into it, maybe. Anyway, every day, every week, you hear new stuff dysfunctioning in the ADOPI. It's like a very, very bad TV series, you know, where all the things happen and in the end you stop laughing.
So do you think Three Strikes is dead, or only the French ADOPI way is dead?
Well, I think the ADOPI is a prehistoric version of modern copyright enforcement. It is Three Strikes 0.9. And we're already aiming towards enforcement 2.0. ACTA, for instance, and SOPA in the US, that is nothing more. Well, it's a bit more. It's ACTA plus the attacks of the US government against WikiLeaks. But you could take ACTA and SOPA side by side and see the very same pattern, where instead of creating a stupid administrative authority like in France that costs millions and is politically unacceptable and unworkable and so on, you privatize the enforcement and you make the copyright industry deal directly with the telecom operators and the service operators, telling them, if you don't do this and this and this and that, and if you don't censor the internet for us, then we will sue you and we will kill you. And with ACTA, it goes as far as new criminal sanctions that could be used to pressure the operators. So if they don't accept to censor the network, they will risk prison sentences. So we're already in a post-ADOPI world. We're already in the enforcement 2.0, where justice is now privatized, censorship is now privatized, and it's even more dangerous and much less funny than Adobe.
Well, you already mentioned ACTA, so maybe you can give a first short introduction, as most of our listeners will know it, but maybe not everyone.
Yeah, so ACTA stands for the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement. It has been disguised as a trade agreement and negotiated in secret for 3 years between the US, the European Union, Japan, Canada, Mexico, and 12 other countries than the EU. And its objective right from the start was to deal in the same way with counterfeited goods and what they call piracy. So the fake Chinese Viagra that kills people and a file shared between individuals. You know, they kill the same, according to them.
And AIDS, AIDS patents and stuff like that.
Yeah. So at first we had to rely on a draft version leaked on WikiLeaks. Then we, as La Quadrature, leaked other versions, and each time we saw basically the same thing I just briefly described. Criminal sanctions, harsh sanctions that go way beyond the TRIPS agreement, which by itself shows that ACTA is much more than a trade agreement. And this is the core of the democratic problem, is that if we accept that unelected representative, the European Commission and the presidency of the Council impose to the European member states new criminal sanction, then we open a breach to a new way, a new parallel legislation to continue. We create a precedent with ACTA. So we create criminal sanction for intermediaries, and we encourage this cooperation I just described between the copyright industry and the service providers, and its cooperation in order to take measures to deter further infringement, which, when you think about it with a technical mind, only amounts to censorship and automated censorship and removal of content. So the status of ACTA is that it has to be accepted by the European Parliament since the Lisbon Treaty. This is kind of a bug in the process of imposing that. And so we have a chance, a little chance, we can win that. It will be difficult, but we can win that the European Parliament rejects ACTA as a whole, which in practice would kill it. So this process just began in the European Parliament. It will take a few months. Several committees of the Parliament will have to formulate and give their opinion. So we'll have at each of these steps occasion for a micro campaign where we'll address the industry committee, then the civil liberties committee, then the development committees, and all along these steps go to the INTA committee, the International Trade Committee, that is the main committee responsible for it, that will make a report on it. And the report will be presented in plenary when there will be the yes or no vote, which I hope will lead to the biggest shitstorm we would ever trigger on the European Parliament. And if we win against ACTA, then I think that we really have a window of opportunity that will open for us to push a positive agenda, to reject copyright enforcement amounting to censorship as a whole, and to try to build something in that context of SOPA and the attacks against WikiLeaks, and even Russia stepping in saying that yeah, they want copyright enforcement as well. And with the rise of global surveillance and global censorship on the internet, this would be a major strategic battle, and I think we cannot afford to lose it.
So it takes some more months?
Yes, it begins right now, but it will take some more months. The final vote cannot be, I think, earlier than April, and it can be indeed forever postponed, but you'll hear again and from it. At each of its step, we'll try to document it as precisely as possible, so everyone can know how they can participate. And sending email is good, but calling the members of the parliament is even more helpful. And then all kind of actions on the internet to raise awareness about this is incredibly helpful. We published a video about ACTA. I don't like to promote centralized services, but if on YouTube you type ACTA, you will see it as a first result, because we reached 1 million view in 1 week about it, shared between YouTube and our own media kit. It was video number 52 most viewed on YouTube the week of its release, so we achieved a huge impact on it. And when people tell you, oh, ACTA, it's too complicated, people don't care, well, you can show them that 1 million people watched at this video already. So publishing videos, publishing images, publishing blog posts, also asking your elected representatives, asking your government, because the presidency of the council worked along with the European Commission in the negotiation. They were there to discuss about the criminal sanction, which is the most violent part of ACTA. And so the presidency of the council represents the member states. Therefore, it represents Germany. Therefore, there is somebody in the German government that were in contact with the presidency to establish the position of the presidency. Finding these persons and asking them about it is also something very, very important that could be very helpful.
I put some links to your ACTA website, to the ETRI manual, and to our Digitale Gesellschaft German translations. With lots of steps to be taken and to be done. How to talk to politicians and what are the arguments against ACTA?
Yeah, exactly.
So people can participate within the next months to fight it.
And the video.
And the video, of course, yeah. That's a really nice video.
Thank you. I'll forward the compliment to the animator who did that for us.
Oh, was it a volunteer
thing? Yes. Very, very fortunate, actually. We received an email saying, well, I just saw Zimmermann on TV, and I like what you do. I do professional animation for television myself, and I want to help. So we replied, oh, well, if you want to help, we could work on this and this and this and this and this and that. And usually after such a second mail, you know, you don't hear any more about the potential volunteers. But the guy said, yeah, okay, come to my studio. And he did a perfect job. He put an intern for 1 month working on it. So you can feel that it's really professional work. And yeah, I think it's really helpful.
Okay. Yeah, the second big topic you're working on is Netzneutralität, net neutrality. And it's a debate we have now started in Germany, but it's going on the European level since the telecom package 3 years ago.
Yes, I remember I wrote this one-pager note called Protecting Net Neutrality in the Telecoms Package in August 2008, just before the Parliament reopened. Sorry for all listeners. And the issue wasn't hot in the first reading of the telecoms package. It's partly our fault because we focused very much on the copyright enforcement that was being sneaked into the telecoms package. And this was the main theme of the first reading. But in the second reading, we managed to put the topic very high on the table. AT&T, the US operator, was the strongest opponent to net neutrality on the EU level, which is very interesting because they don't even operate a network in the EU. And in the end, we have a telecoms package that is, well, neutral, but not in a good neutral. It is not doing anything for net neutrality, but open breaches by saying that operators should say in their contracts and in any revision of their contracts, the conditions of restriction to access to content service and applications. So it implies that operators can restrict access. But on the other hand, in the framework directive is a part where you have the description of the missions of the regulatory authorities, the network regulators, where they say that they should promote the ability for end users to access to any content, service, or application of their choice. So promote the ability to is a bit neutral as a term. Doesn't mean anything. It's not concrete action. But the ability for end users to access any content, service, and application of their choice is by itself a definition of net neutrality. So we have, on this regard, a bad telecoms package, but we could do good transpositions of it. If the promoting the ability, blah, blah, is being transformed into guaranteeing the ability, and that you give to the administrative regulation authority concrete tools to enforce that, then you can use this telecoms package to protect net neutrality. So this is now a part of the debate, is how in each member state will the transposition allow or not to protect net neutrality. And our colleagues in the Netherlands did a wonderful job here. Bits of Freedom, along with the liberal group D66, obtained that part of the transposition of the telecoms package is a very positive definition of net neutrality and sets obligation on the operators. So that's one part in the member states related to the telecoms package. But when the telecoms package ended, in the parliament, they understood there was a problem, and as a way to, so to say, to kick the problem out, they added a note with the telecoms package. I didn't even know they could do that with the directive. You know, it's like putting a post-it on the directive saying, "Please, Commission, do tell us something about it." So please, Mrs. Kroes, the Commissioner for Digital Agenda, tell us what you think about this net neutrality issue. And so Nelly Kroes started working on it. She was supposed to give her a report on the question, I think, 6 months after the end of the telecoms package. In practice, it took her 1.5 years instead of the 6 months. And what is really, really interesting as a comparison is that members of the French Parliament, the Commission for Economic Affairs of the Assemblée Nationale, worked on a similar report on net neutrality. So it took them 6 months to come with a 90-page document saying there is a problem, there is a need for legislative action, next steps should be drafting a law, blah, blah, blah. And 1 week after this French report, Nelly Kroes gave her report after 1.5 years, and it was 12 pages long, and said, we're not even sure there's a problem. Sure, sure, free access to the internet is so important, but we're not sure there's a problem. So we'll ask the BEREC, the newly created body of European regulators, a kind of meta-regulator of the 27 regulators, we'll ask the BEREC to study it, to see if there is a problem. And if there is a problem, then we will give another report. And then if the problem is not solved, maybe we will see blah, 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 blah. At this pace, maybe in 2042, there will be something done by the European Commission. So it is literally, I think, a political strategy from Nelly Kroes. She must be under tremendous pressure by the internet service providers, but also by the equipment makers who have an interest into restricting net neutrality. And her way of acting is by non-acting. This fake wait-and-see approach, as if there was no problem, is actually a way of leaving a blank check to the operators to deploy these technologies of deep packet inspection and other filtering mechanisms. And then it will obviously be too late to roll back those technologies.
You know, it's the same situation we have in Germany, that the government, including the liberals, who haven't done a great job as in the Netherlands, mm-hmm. they say, okay, there's not a problem, mm-hmm. and net neutrality has been solved by the market, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the market is good and transparent, and so, we have net neutrality and mm-hmm. no problem.
Yeah, we heard this market arguments all along the telecoms package when one of the rapporteurs was Malcolm Harbour, the UK liberal. Well, this is bollocks, as they would say in the United Kingdom. sorry again. Because in France, at least, you can tell the three mobile operators on their internet access have exactly the same conditions. They're in an agreement for years about the prices of the communication, about the prices of the SMS, about everything. So they're in an agreement. There is already kind of a market failure here. Why would it be different with restriction to access? So yeah, I think you can, well, not easily, but you can dismantle this argument. But what we have to do at this stage is to make this problem more visible, because it is a very technical problem. It used to be kind of a nerd problem. You know, net neutrality before the telecoms package was really obscure. But in reality, it concerns everybody. If you ask anyone, do you want your internet access to be restricted in any way? They will instantly understand, no. You know, you don't have to explain what is a protocol. Just the concept of having your internet access restricted is unacceptable to most. And we should really take example on what happened in the Netherlands in order to have this vibrant public debate. Somebody was just watching a video of, I think, the General Assembly of KPN, the historical operator, when the CEO, said to the shareholders, oh, and it's great, we have this deep packet inspection technology deployed, we're among the first in the world, and we'll make tons of money out of it. And just one sentence like this, the video got republished, and there was public uproar, massive mass media attention, and so on, and this is how they got the law adopted. So it is our duty at the moment to explain the importance of net neutrality. We should make small animated videos explaining net neutrality. We should make scenarios. We should explain that to more and more journalists. And we should also illustrate concrete examples of how urgent the situation is and how the operators, as of today, already restrict net neutrality. And that's the objective of this platform, Respect MyNet, that you promoted and relayed, and you're part of the first to, well, you participated to it. Respect MyNet is a citizen reporting platform where at first nerds, network nerds, and we hope as soon as possible standard users will be able to report infringement to net neutrality. So why do I say nerd? Is because today you have to be able to understand how the network works to make measurement almost by hand, or to have tried already something that didn't work, to know it doesn't work. You have to try to open an SSH connection from your mobile phone to realize it doesn't open, to realize, oh, my operator is blocking port 22. So far it is a bit complicated to do these reports, but there are tools that exist that we promote, and we hope that new tools, more accessible, more usable, will be developed soon. So the idea is that you, as a citizen, as a user, go to respectmynet.eu or respectmy.net and say, hey, I'm using Vodafone, for example, in Germany on a mobile contract called blah, 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 unlimited. And when I try to open an SSH connection, it fails. And here is, eventually as a bonus, a dump of the network communication when I try to do so. And then other people can come and say, oh, I'm also on Vodafone unlimited blah, blah. And I notice I have the same problem. So I click here and I confirm. And then somebody else will come, oh, I'm also on Vodafone unlimited blah blah, so I will try port 22. And it fails as well. So I confirm. And you can also comment and so on. And so when we have a few dozens of people who confirm a problem, then we can safely consider that it is real. And now we have currently 70 breaches to net neutrality that were confirmed all over Europe. That's 10 member states. And that's mostly, I think, because we didn't get an outreach to the other member states, rather than thinking that the 17 remaining member states are totally fine with net neutrality. So there is still a lot of work to do on that. I think it's already 26 operators that are being concerned with that. So the more attention we'll have on the issue, the more reports we'll have on RespectMyNet, the more confirmation of the respect and scrutiny over the reports we'll have, the more obvious it will be that there is a problem with net neutrality, the more unavoidable it will be for the politicians, and the easier it will be to try to force Mrs. Cruz into action. The next step is for the BEREC, the body of European regulators, to give their study, their fact-finding exercise, the results as soon as late January, I think, and then in the very next weeks or months, Nelly Cruz will give a report based on BEREC study. So the time is really now, in the next days, in the next weeks, to make the topic hot and to get reports and confirmations.
And you are still looking for volunteers to help improve the platform?
Yes, we always need volunteers. So we need people to promote Respect MyNet and call for people to make reports and to confirm reports. We need people to work as admins to validate the new reports, validate the comment, ensure that there is no spam. And we need also people to help with the web design. So far, the interface is a bit nerdy. It looks like a big Excel spreadsheet. We need to add more color, more visuals, and more impact to the whole. The project is somewhere on GitHub, I think. If you contact me directly, jz@laquadrature.net, I will direct you to the mailing list that you can join and where you can participate. But yeah, I think the most useful way of helping at the moment is really by making some noise about the question of net neutrality, promoting this idea of net neutrality and putting it on the table, putting it on political agendas, making it visible.
So we are in the beginning of 2012. What have you seen in 2011 changing in the political landscape?
Well, to me, something extremely interesting is to watch separate entities that actually may have something in common. If you look at WikiLeaks, then at Anonymous, then at Telecomics, and then as this Indignados or Occupy movement of people in the street, you witness, I wouldn't even call them political movements, but political forces that emerge out of nowhere, that rely completely on a free internet, that are sometimes massively distributed or involve people from all over the world, and that achieve huge awareness and political change in ways that were unknown before and that are radically different from the logic of the political parties. I wonder if this is not the first versions that we witness of some global political forces that may be able to address the global threat we have on a free internet, or maybe the global financial issues or global environmental issues or things like that.
And how was the reaction of the political landscape to it? When it came to net politics?
Well, you remember how strong was the reaction of the US government against WikiLeaks.
And only US government.
Yeah, not only US government, it's true. But the pressure on Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal, and Amazon is one of the most violent attack against any structure we've seen that didn't involve weapons. So this is one example that comes to my mind. Indeed, the other governments reacted the same. In French, everybody simulated outrage, saying that the privacy of the state was being violated. I love this concept, privacy of the state. And the Minister of Digital Economy, Eric Besson, even asked his services to come with a solution on how to make sure that WikiLeaks won't be hosted in France anymore, which indeed miserably failed. So there is this hostile reaction to WikiLeaks. I don't remember seeing a structured reaction against Anonymous, but half jokingly, I did that bet already that Anonymous may be the next Al Qaeda in the storytelling, I mean. A ubiquitous enemy that is invisible, that you must fight at all costs, that would justify to go beyond the rule of law, that would justify an e-Patriot Act or things like that, is something I suspect in my worst scenarios. Telecomics, well, we cannot really know what was the reaction of the Syrian or Egyptian government, because they're either so secretive and closed or falling when those events happen.
I was going to say, even by more hardware software by Western companies to solve the problem.
Mm, yeah.
It's a matter of putting more money on...
Yeah, but I don't remember looking at... Political reaction to that. And, well, the Occupy or Indignados movement has been, the way the press handled it, I think, shows at least concern. The way in the US Occupy Wall Street was so underreported or always reported in the same elements of language, of being disorganized, blah, 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 blah. Shows, I think, that people either don't understand at all or are very much worried that this could lead to something bigger. And I'm very eager to see what will come in 2012 from those seeds, what will emerge from all of that.
So when we come to 2012, what will be the main topics on the European level?
Well, we already talked about net neutrality and ACTA. If ACTA is adopted, then right afterwards will be probably the modification of the IPRED directive, the IP enforcement, so the copyright directive. Then also will be the revision of the privacy directive, but you people in Germany know much more than I do about it, but I think it will be also a very, very crucial battle. It is very interesting to see that a first draft was leaked, that it appears to be extremely encouraging, not perfect, but with very good measures, that it has been said in the last weeks that US companies, including Google, are flying lobbyists in Brussels to come and try to destroy those provisions.
Even the US government is doing a heavenly lobbying campaign on the European level.
Yeah, so we will see a real shitstorm of lobbying on the EU on that question, and I think it will be a very interesting battle. That's mostly what I have in my radar, but maybe I forget something.
Will we have another censorship debate with on child pornography with Sensilia? We had some wins, we got some losses, but it's not coming to all Europe that we have to block websites with child pornography on it. It's the member states can solve the problem if they want.
Yes.
But when we take a look on SOPAR, the Stop Online Piracy Act in the US in the moment, do you think we will have such a debate on the European level?
Well, several things. First of all, it's extremely encouraging to see that SOPAR is now the object of a massive movement, a massive uproar of civil society and industry actors. I don't remember seeing such a big campaign in the US. And, well, it will probably have no impact on the House of Representatives, because it has been shown and mapped already that the promoters of SOPA got so much more funding from the copyright industry that, yeah, all is said. But nevertheless, we've seen in the past text being adopted, but nevertheless the political victory be on our side. If SOPA is adopted in total illegitimacy with everybody booing at it, it will be extremely hard to implement. And so it's more important, I think, that we win politically by raising awareness and having everybody to understand the problem than solving the text itself. SOPA amounts to censorship. SOPA is the equivalent of ACTA. So we should not laugh by looking at SOPA thinking, oh, it's the US, it's okay. No. At the opposite, I think we should find ways, us Europeans, to try to wait in the SOPA debate, as we should hope that the US could help to wait in the ACTA debate in the EU. What is really interesting, I think, and now there is a whole new angle that develops with the spy files and the exposure of this spying industry that you briefly mentioned, is that if you look at it from a perspective, political censorship in the Egypt of Mubarak or in China, restriction of internet access by the operators restriction of net neutrality to make new business models, and censorship in the name of copyright, such as SOPA or ACTA, are basically the very same hardware, the very same technologies. All of them involve first easy DNS, domain, filters, then URL proxies, and then whenever it fails and whenever a new generation of hardware appears, you go to the deep packet inspection, and then you generalize deep packet inspection. And all of those restrictions could be in a way summarized by this technology that is designed to restrict our freedom of communication, that is designed to restrict our freedom of expression, and that is not tolerable. So maybe we will find a way in 2012 to bridge these issues together and put at the center the question of the deployment of these deep packet inspection technologies. And maybe, well, let's hope crazy things and try to make them happen. But maybe we could ban the use of this deep packet inspection technology and make it a standard, like, I don't know, like banning landmines or nuclear proliferation or something like this.
Yeah, this should be a new European transnational campaign we should do.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. Yeah, we already started with echtesnetz.de, our campaign for net neutrality, to say, okay, one of our demands is we have to forbid this risk technology, the packet inspection, because there may be legal purposes you can use it, but the risk is too high that this technology is used against us as consumers, as citizens.
Yeah, but actually, we must oppose deep packet inspection, but also consider the other tools for censorship, such as URL proxies and so on, because I think that in China, for instance, they combine all the technologies together. Some domains are banned, some URLs are banned, and some communication are inspected. So, yeah, we have to oppose censorship technologies as a whole, and expose the manufacturers, expose the operators who deploy them. And yeah, we are a legion and we can shine light on all this.
Yeah, last topic I have in mind is the data retention, which the Vorratsdatenspeicherung, which was a very huge topic in Germany. We won at the Supreme Court, but now it's back in the debate, and we want to, the government is debating if they want to re-implement it or not. Was it a debate in France? So you already have this data retention. How long is it working? So how many months are they restoring? And was there a debate or is it still a debate?
There was approximately no debate.
Why?
It was implemented in 2004. So we weren't structured at all, okay, like we are today at the time. And it was in the law that was the transposition of the e-commerce directive. And I think it transposed as well the data retention. When was it, the data retention directive?
Was it 2005 on the European level.
I thought that the LCEN in France was its transposition.
Yeah, maybe you maybe already wasn't. Had it.
Maybe, oh, yeah. And there was... in the law, so maybe it wasn't 2004, but 2005. But there was in the law the need for a décret d'application, an executive order that would specify later the scope of the retention and the duration of the retention. And we were expecting this for years. At first, a very minimal one said, okay, 1 year and just connection data. But we were expecting a new order to be published, and it got published some months ago, and so there was a little bit of debate, but you understand that it's on the very last stage where there is nothing that can be done, but at least there is a bit of attention. It was said among the retained data should be the passwords or ways to recover them. So if the passwords are stored full text, which is not a good idea, you retain them. And if hashes are stored, then you retain the hashes as well. So I think it is one of the the strongest or the most invasive implementation of data retention I've heard so far. But no, as a general rule, I think, and I don't like to generalize, but I think that data retention, part of the wider privacy debate, is much less important in the public sphere in France than it is in Germany. I think you're really leading this fight in Germany for, well, various historical reasons and so on. And so we are very much hoping that you will continue the good work. And if it comes back on the EU level, indeed, it will be time for a strong alliance and campaign. But I don't know. I think the revision of... there is an ongoing work by the Commission to study if there is a need for revision or something like this.
Yeah, but only 14 states of the 27 states replied.
Oh, okay.
With numbers, but the statistics, they don't show any purpose mm-hmm. of the data retention. So, yeah, only for some, here was a big murder with six killings, and this is the reason we need to store the communication data of all citizens.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get statistics in favor of data retention or against. In both cases, it is a very difficult exercise. But yes, I think we're in the very, very early stages where the Commission may ask itself if it is necessary or not to revise the framework for data retention. So it means that it's the beginning of an opening where we could have an occasion to put again the debate on the table. I think that when it was adopted on the EU level, it was under the UK presidency, right after the bombings in London.
Yeah, so Madrid was also.
Exactly. So it was in the context of the terrorist craze, where when people from the enforcement come and say we need this and this and that to fight the terrorist, the policymaker just does it. So maybe if we can have a more relaxed debate, a more dispassionate debate, it will be an occasion to talk about it again on the EU level, yes.
And do you know how long ISPs in French have to restore data? In Germany it was 6 months.
And I think it is 1 year.
Minimum. Okay.
I think it is 1 year in France, yeah.
And it was no debate within the Hadopi debate that for 1 year they have to store the IP addresses?
No debate. Actually, the Hadopi only concerns IP addresses spotted on peer-to-peer networks. So the ISPs cannot retain this kind of data. No, it wasn't. The privacy part of the Hadopi debate was, once again, much lower than other aspects. It was in the debate, but it wasn't a primary angle where I'm sure that in Germany it would have been on top of the list.
Okay, then thank you for the overview
about your work. It's a great pleasure, and as usual.
Now we will do the next podcast in the next year.
Invite Corey first.
if he comes back to Germany until that. Okay. Yeah, but thank you for your work. Thank you for being my guest again. And it was a pleasure. And keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, and auf Wiedersehen.
Tschüss.